How's it going, everybody? This is the Say Goodnight Kevin podcast. If you just can't get enough of Say Goodnight Kevin, or you really appreciate what we do here and you want to support the show, head over to SGK Plus or just saygoodnightkevin.com/SGK Plus or just saygoodnightkevin.com. We have just recently launched SGK Plus. It's a place where you can support the show and also get even more content from Say Goodnight Kevin. We got new stuff coming out very soon. Very excited, so check that out if you like. All right, well, on today's episode, I'm really excited to talk to a friend of mine who's a recent friend of mine, but we met at a Christian film festival. We both were speaking at this festival talking about Christian film and storytelling and all sorts of stuff. His name's Tyler Smith. It was really cool to get to meet him because I think him and I really hit it off just right away. We started talking about films, and he has been a critic for a long time, you know, writing actual criticism of movies, but he also has taught. He's been a podcast host for a long time with a podcast called Battleship Pretension. So we talk about all of that stuff, but also he just recently released a film that is called Real Redemption, and it is a movie basically going through a lot of the history of Christian movies in general. And obviously I do a lot of criticism of Christian films, but I wouldn't have started a podcast where I talk about the stuff if I didn't find it in some way fascinating and interesting. So I think he does a really great job with that. And so we talk about that. All right. So strap in and get ready for my conversation with Tyler Smith. Here we go.
Now, the accountability partner no one asked for, Kevin McCreary. Here's Say Goodnight Kevin.
How's it going, everybody? Welcome to the Say Goodnight Kevin podcast. I am here with Tyler Smith. Can I say your last name?
Yes.
Okay. I mean,
you can kind of guess it if you try.
He's one of the Tyler Smiths. Out there.
Years ago, I was on Facebook. I was invited to a Facebook group that is literally just Tyler Smith's. That was it. And so I was like, sure, why not? And then people are posting stuff. I was like, I have nothing in common with these people except my name. Why did I do this? And I left immediately.
I joined a McCreary Facebook group, which there were probably fewer, but it mm-hmm. wasn't Kevin McCreary Facebook groups. In fact, I was able to get kevinmccreary.com. At some point it was owned by someone else at first, but then they just let it expire and I got it. I jumped on that.
Oh boy.
I do nothing with it.
Better to have it and not need it than need it and not
exactly.
have it.
Exactly. That's how I feel about my gun.
You have a gun? It's a shame that people can't see the video because you looked off as though it's just sitting at the end of your desk.
It's
the ready.
It's here in my hand. I don't know how things are going to go in this interview.
That's true.
So we've talked about nothing so far.
Sure.
Which is great. That's what this podcast is all about. But
that's what most of them are about.
Yes. Two white dudes talking about nothing.
Exactly. But they find themselves so very funny.
Oh, they do. Like we do. You have a movie. So a lot of times I'll get directors, big name directors on here. Alex Kendrick, Dallas Jenkins. That's it. Those are my two friends. I've burnt all my other bridges. But you have a movie that is not in theaters.
That's right. It was going to get a multi-theater release, mm-hmm. you know, around the country. Oh, this damn coronavirus.
Oh, my goodness. We met, you and I, at a film festival, and mm-hmm. you were working on this at that point.
It was in the final stages, just going back and forth, trying to figure out like on-screen text and stuff. But it was mostly done by that time.
That's cool. Yeah. So it is called?
It's called Real Redemption, R-E-E-L.
Whoa.
Yeah, I know. Crazy, right? Real Redemption, The Rise of Christian Cinema, and it's available on the Faith Life TV streaming platform. If you are unaware of that streaming platform, you have company.
Join the
vast,
club.
Vast majority of people. It's as a platform, I actually think it's pretty good. It's not necessarily movie based. There's a lot of documentaries. It's more just like a really solid resource for Christians.
Okay.
It's like $5 a month. But hey, don't tell anybody I told you this. You get 2 weeks free.
Whoa.
So if you want to sign up, watch my movie, and then if you decide I've had it, I'm leaving. Look, no one's going to hold it against you. I won't.
You already got the view.
I got the view. I got the click and I got the money.
Nice. Well,
and that's
it
why
really
anybody
is
gets into Christian film.
The clicks.
The clicks, yes.
So what's interesting, I watched it this week, and man, you go deep into the history of Christianity, and I guess I would say faith in general, but it's primarily like Anglo-Christian.
Like Judeo-Christian.
Yeah.
Very much so.
Which I find all of that fascinating. If I didn't, I wouldn't have started a podcast and a YouTube channel about it. So there was a lot of stuff that I didn't know. Why did you make this?
There are multiple reasons, some of them big and lofty, and some of them just purely logistical. I found myself with some time available. That's one. But that's not very inspiring. It came about because going pretty far back, when I went back to school to get my master's, I went to UCLA, and one of the questions, like during the introduction process, like all everybody that had been accepted to the master's or the PhD program, we were all in a room, and there are various instructors giving presentations, and then one of them said, like, you know, if you have any questions right now, now's the time to ask them. And I said, is there anything that film academia is not talking about or hasn't talked about? Because that's the other thing, is like when you go into academia at this point, it's just like, yeah, outside of talking about, honestly, the importance of YouTube and the effect of YouTube, there really isn't that much being talked about. There isn't that much that hasn't already been talked about ad nauseum. And so she's like, oh, you know what? I can't really think of anything. And then later, but that became a question that I would ask to my instructors. And then one of them who taught an Alfred Hitchcock class, he and I have a very similar background, and he had actually listened to my podcast before we knew each other. And so because we had a similar background, he mentioned that something academia never talks about, because it doesn't take it very seriously, is the world of faith-based film, which is still relatively new in the world of film history. And because the movies are just not very good, and because academics and critics alike tend to see them first and foremost as just a way to pander to a certain group or whatever, they may review them, but they really don't take them seriously from an academic standpoint. And so I wrote an essay about it, and that got the attention of some people, including some people at Faith Life. And I thought, wouldn't it be interesting, because an essay is only going to go so far, wouldn't it be interesting to make a film or a documentary that can, on one hand, give Christian viewers a lot of information about the history of film, but then also show non-Christian critics and just general movie fans, get them thinking about faith-based film in a slightly different way. So that's a very long answer to your question, but it essentially came about because I saw that there was a gap. And don't get me wrong, I don't think my micro-budget video essay-style documentary on Faith Life TV is going to fill that gap.
You did it.
But
you succeeded. Mission accomplished.
I put it out there anyway, to kind of start a conversation.
You mentioned your background. What is your background? Like, I'm sure this movie isn't where you were born.
oh, wow. That's an abstract way of asking that. I'm originally from Taft, California, which is outside of Bakersfield. And for anybody who lives in California, I'll let the phrase outside Bakersfield really sink in, because it is a sad concept. Then we moved to Ventura, we moved to Colorado, Southern Missouri. And then my dad worked in the oil industry, so we moved around a lot. And then I went to film school in Chicago, where I majored in film, but I didn't have a specific concentration. So I focused on writing, directing, and criticism. And then shortly after getting married, my wife and I moved to Los Angeles, where I wanted to pursue screenwriting. But while I was doing that, I also started a podcast called Battleship Pretension, which I very quickly found infinitely more fulfilling than any kind of writing I might've been doing. And so I started to pursue criticism, and that's what I've been doing for a long time. And as a function of that, I got to speak at some colleges, and out of that, I really got this desire to teach. So I went back to school, got my master's in cinema and media studies. And these days, though I still do criticism, these days I focus primarily on instruction. So I teach at a couple of community colleges And that's basically all me. That's all you need to know.
Nice. Well, not everybody is a student of film in general. So explain to my audience the name of your podcast.
Oh, yes. Okay. Battleship Pretension is, I wish I could say I came up with the name. I didn't. My co-host did. And my initial reaction was like, ha, 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 well, we can't call it that. But we eventually, and we told various friends and they all said, you can't call it that. And it is essentially a pun on the old Russian silent film Battleship Potemkin. The humor here being, hypothetically, that if you get it, you might actually be a little bit pretentious yourself. And that you would but you know what? We decided to go with it, and we've actually gotten so many compliments on that title, enough that it got people's attention, who would then go on to go to be on the show. And so it's like, okay, I'm glad we stuck with our stupid film school concept, and we went with this ridiculous name.
What's funny is you can watch that movie if you have Amazon Prime for free. So
I think you can watch it on YouTube as well. But a lot of people aren't super keen on watching a Russian silent film.
You can't watch it while you're playing on your phone.
That's true.
Because you have to watch it.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the struggle.
I'm a pretty big proponent of silent film, which is not a thing that most people care that much about, which is fine. I don't begrudge them that. Like, filmmaking is so different than what it was 100 years ago that you just can't expect somebody to just jump right into a silent film. Even something like a Charlie Chaplin or a Buster Keaton film, which are tend to be the most accessible ones, but at the same time, like, if you watch certain silent movies, like, they're just so visually beautiful, and the directors, because they have to rely so only on the visuals, they are able to realize stuff that filmmakers, once the introduction of sound came along, just showed actually very little interest in. Unless they were overtly referencing German silent movies of the 1920s, like Tim Burton so often does.
It's interesting because it feels like so much reverts back to the stage whenever we get into sound. Yeah. Things revert back to more of kind of the structure of a stage performance and a lot of the rules of a stage performance, where in silent film, even though they're, you know, Charlie Chaplin came from stage performances, there was a understanding that, wow, we can do a lot of things. We can do stunts and we can have bigger things because we can't fit a whole house inside of a stage. Or on a stage, so we could build one and knock the whole thing over.
Yeah.
A lot of those types of, I mean, and this is, I'm generalizing, but it does seem like a lot of the popular stuff, once sound came along, almost got cheaper.
Yeah, I think studios, I mean, obviously the sound equipment limited what they were able to do, as you can see in Singing in the Rain, if you ever watched that. Mm. But it also came down to, like, studios, because sound kind of surprised them. They weren't really prepared for how popular it was going to be. So suddenly it's like, okay, we need scripts. How do we do? We need scripts that can be shot pretty easily and in a very minimal kind of way, because again, we're limited by the microphone. And so of course they turn to playwrights, because, and in some cases would just try to adapt a play, which is already pretty stagey. And so it's like, okay, we don't have to worry about anything too ambitious visually if we do this. That lasted for maybe about 5 to 7 years before you start getting, it's like, okay, now we've got The Adventures of Robin Hood and Gone with the Wind in the late 30s. So
yeah,
it didn't take a long time, but those first, I mean, it sounds crazy, but like those first few sound films are pretty boring, because not only visually are they uninteresting, but also it's almost like the novelty of people talking was seen as enough.
Right.
And so you just get people talking and that was it, which, hey, it gives the actors something to do, which is great. But at the same time, like, considering what film can be, not super dynamic. There's a reason we don't talk that much about many of them.
Yeah.
We talk about, you know, All Quiet on the Western Front, because that one is a little bit more ambitious. We talk about those early Universal horror movies like Frankenstein, which is 1931, but there aren't many others.
So when researching this film, what's one thing that really surprised you, that stuck out to you?
Hmm.
or that like you were not expecting to find out?
I think that's a really good question, because a lot, as I started making this, a lot of this was stuff that I already just kind of knew and then had to dig deeper into.
I think a lot of people who would watch my show or listen kind of generally, like, we know, yeah, there've been some Christian movies, especially anything that happened after Passion of the Christ. We kind of know these things have come out, and we know there were some cheesy things, and there's a push in the 80s to Christians to separate and stuff like that.
Yeah, I think it's less about any one thing and more about the degree to which that one thing occurred. And so, for example, I knew that there was controversy around Last Temptation of Christ. Like, I knew that. And I knew that there were a lot of people that pushed against the Passion of the Christ, for example. But then once you have to start digging for clips, that's a very different thing. Like, to simply know about it in a broad sense is one thing. But then when you actually see the way people talk about these movies, whether they be in favor of or against, you know, you become, it becomes in some cases quite disheartening. You know, when talking about Last Temptation of Christ, like, there were certain Christian commentators who were clearly intelligent. They clearly valued film as an art form, and yet they were unable, or one could say unwilling, to see what that movie was actually doing as opposed to what they thought it was doing. Like, they just couldn't get past some of the events or images presented in the film. And meanwhile, it's like, yeah, but if you look at the whole of the film, it's not condoning this thing. And that goes back to this idea that a lot of Christians tend to think that simply to depict something is to endorse it.
Yeah.
And it's like, that's not how somebody like a Martin Scorsese thinks.
And even to the degree that it's one thing to say, well, this is smutty. There's a naked woman in the movie, so I'm not going to watch it. My kids aren't going to see it because I want to stay away from, I don't want to look at naked women for religious purposes. Is one thing, but you could say that about anything that has breasts in it or whatever.
Yeah.
But to have kind of a deeper level, or even to say, like, it's offensive to me to have to depict Jesus in any way like this. But it was really fascinating to see the clips of the anger and the completely writing off that there is could possibly be any merit or anything important said in this movie is beyond just, I don't feel comfortable seeing it.
Right. That's like, there are a couple people who simply say this film has no value. I'm like, are you kidding me? No value, not even artistic value, not even structural value or visual value. Like, literally this thing, because
it doesn't. Or the soundtrack with the rock music when Jesus has his whole gang together. They're walking towards the camera.
The music is by Peter Gabriel, and that's a really good score. I don't know if you're joking or not, but
I think
it works really well.
I'm half joking because there's that moment almost pushes the movie to cheesy.
There's
a rock
moment
where I'm like, well, this is about to get Avengers-y.
And I do
think it doesn't quite get there, but it is a bit humorous.
And I do think there's something interesting about Last Temptation and the way Scorsese chooses to make it, where he makes it uniquely American.
Mm-hmm.
Like the fact that Jesus and the disciples they just use their natural voices. They're not trying to do any kind of accent. And then the music is anachronistic. He really does seem to be trying to make this relatable in its own way. And then the fact that, like, the Romans all have British accents and that Pilate is played by David Bowie in a great performance, by the way, I think. It's really, you know, so it's like, not only are our heroes American, but their oppressors are British.
Yeah.
And to me, decisions like that, you know, I seem to recall, I think, like, Harvey Keitel was nominated for a Razzie. He plays Judas. And they're like, oh, you know, and even a lot of reviews, even complimentary reviews say, like, it's like, oh, Harvey Keitel in full Brooklyn mode. And part of me's like, yeah, but Scorsese is a smart enough director that, and Keitel's a good enough actor that if they wanted to do something different, they would have and could have. which means they chose to do that. So rather than simply say, boy, that's a weird choice, the end, why not ask why they did it?
Because that is interesting. There are a few directors. I actually felt that way about Interstellar.
Oh, Interstellar. I actually like Interstellar quite a bit.
I have a few theories, just thoughts that I talk about in small talk with friends. But like, there's a certain level whenever there's directors that you know can do good things or have proven themselves. Because I like Nolan, and I know that Christopher Nolan thinks about everything that he does in his movies, that when he does something, instead of just doing the CinemaSins countdown, you're able to sit back and enjoy the ride in a way that I think a bad movie oftentimes will remind me early on. I'm like, oh, wait, I thought I was about to watch a good movie and I'm afraid I'm not in good hands here, that I then start noticing things within the movie that maybe I'd been in more capable hands. Because you can find a lot in Scorsese's movies. He'll actually leave mistakes in. There's a part in the phone booth in Goodfellas where you can see the reflection of the camera.
Sure.
And he left it in. But I think he left it in because of the performance. And so you can just that easily say, I know that mistake's there, but why was it left in? And he's the type of director who will he'll leave an out-of-focus shot in there if the performance was good.
Yeah, and, you know, Spielberg is another one. Like, there are certain filmmakers that sometimes think in a broader way. And so a website as completely innocuous as CinemaSins, which I absolutely hate. I hate everything about CinemaSins. It's not funny. It's not insightful. It's just this thing that exists and is the essence of almost everything I hate about the way certain people watch movies. Anyway, you know, you watch
another
something
place
like
I used to work.
So. Oh, really? How are they doing?
They're doing great. They're making a lot of money.
They're doing way better than either of us.
Yes.
So we're punching up, I guess.
Yeah, they're here in Nashville. And I worked for the company that like started out of them. No, I have nothing. They're nice people. The two guys who started it. The company wasn't a great place to work. So.
Oh, okay.
And they're not extremely involved, but I did edit a few things. But everyone there also feels the same way. That's the funny thing. Like, they're stuck doing it.
What a hellish life.
Could you imagine? And what's weird is there's this lack of understanding of whether they're a comedy riff show or a true analysis. And so they'll do stuff and they'll edit something in a way that changes it. And then they'll make that a sin. And it's like, but that's not how it was in the movie.
Yeah.
So why is ding?
When you're torn like that, you wind up doing neither of them very well.
Yes.
But you know, you watch something like Jurassic Park, and when the T-Rex attacks that car, he just steps over, like, you know, she rips through the formerly electrified fence and just steps over like what, probably a 5-foot concrete barrier. It's not even really a barrier, but she just steps over that and everything's fine. But then when the time comes to throw a car back over, it's like a 40-foot drop. And just like, that is an inconsistency that Spielberg is a smart enough director to know that that's an inconsistency and not care.
Yeah.
Because I think there is this attitude, and I think it depends on how good the movie is and who's actually adopting the attitude, but this feeling of like, if people are noticing that, then I haven't done anything right to this point. Because in that moment, it's all about peril and what can we do to raise the stakes. And it's like having them possibly fall as this car comes falling, you know, missing them by inches. It's just like, we're just upping the peril, you know? And similarly, at the end when the character is about to be killed by raptors and then the T-Rex just bursts out of the frame, it's like,
where did he come from?
Where did he come from? This is an animal that has announced itself every single time.
Was there no water to vibrate in that museum? Yeah.
But it it comes back to this kind of this basic idea of media literacy, where if something is the way we watch movies or TV or even look at photographs, if something is out of the frame, it literally doesn't exist.
Yeah.
You know, there are entire comedy and horror sequences, the two often go together, but like comedy or horror sequences where something comes in from out of the frame and it's very funny or scary. But if you actually think about the geography of where these characters are, it's like that thing bursting out of the frame, they would have seen that coming 30 feet away, but it's outside of the frame. So it's outside of, we're not even thinking about that.
Right. It's and like I think the, there are the discussion of the Halloween movies and Mike Myers, is he a superhero because he can get, he would have to run so fast to get from one place that he kills to another place that it would be impossible when the camera's not on him. He's moving super, like at super speed. Well, that's not what the movie's about.
Yeah. You're asking very much the wrong question. If that's what you want, if that's what you want out of a movie, then I would say don't watch any movie, even documentaries, because through the editing process or even the addition of sound, movies are inherently, art in general, but I'd say movies are inherently manipulative, and that doesn't necessarily have to be a bad thing. When a person's manipulative, that's not good. But but art has to manipulate you or has to manipulate the footage or whatever in order to accomplish what it's trying to do. And that's not a, that is not a sin. Or a cinema.
That's it. Well, it's an interesting perspective because we're speaking in of movies in general, and oftentimes you and I have both criticized Christian movies for doing something similar, which is manipulating, so to speak.
Yeah.
What do you think the difference is there then between Jurassic Park manipulating the audience into thinking a T-Rex can sneak up on someone? And God's Not Dead, making you believe that this guy could become a Christian before he dies?
Because I think there's, every film has its own internal logic, all right? And when it comes to Spielberg, he tends to think in cinema logic. And so the sequences I just talked about, they have a certain emotional logic rooted in the fear of the characters and the genre in which it's being made or presented. And so he can do these things and he does them extremely well, you know? And so it, similarly, like if I, like there are ways that I could manipulate you that are extremely clumsy. If I simply said, hey, you should give me $10 and you're a bad friend if you don't, that is clumsy manipulation, you know? Whereas if I take the time and actually like in true, like Glengarry Glen Ross fashion, if I talk at length about something that has nothing to do with $10, and then I subtly bring it back around to the point where you actually now think that you want to give me $10, and it sounds like I haven't asked for it, it's something you're volunteering, that's good manipulation. So you know, the way that Christian films are manipulative, they know what their goal is, but they're not willing to put in the work or the time or the patience in order to achieve, to get that goal, to arrive at that goal in a way that the audience got there as well. Instead, they're trying to grab the audience by the hand and pull them along and say, no, this is where we're going. And I think the best movies, Christian or otherwise, are the ones that present the information, present the story, present the visuals in a way that just feels totally organic, so that when you, so that you want something to happen without feeling like the film wants me to want this.
Yeah.
It just happens naturally. And it's, you know, you can break it down on a, on an almost scientific level, but when it comes right down to it, there's an intangibility, how all of these things are working together. And the best directors are the ones that just seem to understand instinctively and intellectually, but instinctively, how to cut something, shoot something, compose something, whatever it is, bring it all together so that it all feels like just a natural, organic process for the audience.
I see movies very much, very similar to magic.
Sure.
'Cause in many ways they are. I really love watching Fool Us with Penn and Teller.
Sure.
I'm a big Penn and Teller fan. I like most things that they do, except their atheist stuff really makes me mad. Not really. I'm always giving you dry jokes and you're like, is he
Now, I was just thinking that, like, did you ever watch their show, which I don't think I can say the name of on BS. This podcast? That's the one.
Yeah.
That was a really great show. And of course they spent some time on the Bible, and it's just like, yeah, I don't agree with them, but yeah, whatever.
Sometimes whenever you do agree with the thing that they're criticizing, you can see the cracks in the way they approach it. And so I like seeing that and analyzing that as well. And it makes me think, okay, so the ones that I did agree with, were there cracks in those? And then I realized, no, because I agree with it. And
of course.
So it's fine. But it's good to challenge yourself.
What a delightful coincidence.
Yeah, that everything I agree with is irrefutable. So in the same way, like, what's interesting about Penn and Teller and the way they approach magic is from a desire to expose truth. Mm. And they're almost to the point that it hurts them in terms of entertainment sometimes, that they want to make sure everybody knows that this is not real, that magic does not exist. And you watch Fool Us and they have kind of a vendetta in that realm, but I think it's better because it isn't real. And I think that's in the Houdini school of thought. And I think that does correlate very much with films. Spielberg does not wish to make you believe that dinosaurs are real, in that there actually is a theme park with dinosaurs.
Right, yeah.
He wants you to believe there are real things that he wants you to believe, like the nature of man and the tendency between, you know, capitalism and going too far or exploring. Sometimes, you know, they spending all your time thinking about what you can do instead of what you should do. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there are real life truths that are presented, but those truths are presented in a fictional world. And I think that's because Penn and Teller can be very entertaining with mm-hmm. their magic, all while always standing firm on this idea of truth and not manipulating you and making sure you know that they're not really making someone levitate. And they'll even do the trick, the ball, the cup and ball trick with clear cups. Mm-hmm. And it's like, whoa, that's impressive still, because they're so good at sleight of hand that they're just really good at it. But yet, if someone were to take that magic and attempt to tell you, this is Jesus doing this, that's manipulative. And there's a part of me that feels that a lot of Christian movies do that. They take the magic of filmmaking, which, going back to Interstellar, one of the criticisms of Interstellar is that, no guy would just leave his family super fast like that. And to me, I feel like a movie that is based on time and mm-hmm. the fourth dimension and stuff, it's not that he left his family that fast. It's that, looking back on it, he would always perceive that he left his family quick. And also, all of that didn't happen in 2 hours.
Right, exactly, yeah.
Movies are magic, and they have the ability to make you feel like you have experienced an entire lifetime within this tiny time frame using different techniques of trickery and manipulation, but you go in asking to be manipulated for the sake of entertainment, just like a magic show. And it's frustrating with directors who are less capable, who aren't very good magicians, to be pulled out of that and to be reminded. Carmen and I, my wife, we saw a magician once in Pigeon Forge, and he was terrible. And the whole time, all I could do was think about how he was doing it and figuring out how he does the trick, where Penn and Teller can do something and I don't care how they do it because it's so entertaining. And I think movies so often are that way. But there's something extra frustrating or sinister about somebody taking that sort of magic and trying to manipulate. And I think that's what manipulation is an attempt to manipulate in a way that you have not told the audience, where they didn't pay for this, where they aren't aware that you are manipulating and making them believe that you really can do magic. But that's hard, I think, because people do believe that God is real.
I remember when I lived in Southern Missouri, I went to Branson a few times. I saw a couple of shows, not very many, but there was a magic show by a guy named Kirby Van Burch, which is just a ridiculous name. But I don't know if that's his actual
name.
All
the other names were taken.
Yeah, kind of. Yeah. And it was a really amazing magic show. Very polished. You know, he made a helicopter appear, which is kind of crazy.
A real helicopter?
Yeah.
Wow.
It was like right there on the stage where previously there was nothing. And it's just like, wow. And on one hand, it's like, how did he do that? But on the other hand, it's like, I don't really care.
Yeah.
But what's interesting is it being Southern Missouri, at the end of his show, he goes, obviously, I didn't do any magic here. This is all, these are all illusions. I'm not going to tell you how I did them, but there are all kinds of logistical decisions being made behind the scenes. And then he actually goes on to talk about, like, he goes, but, and then he says like a Christian message,
yeah,
you know, and talks about like the magic that Jesus did was real. And that, like, don't put your faith in me. Don't put your faith in what man can do. Do put your faith in what Jesus can do. And on one hand, I appreciate that he saved that for the end.
Yeah.
Because it draws a very clear line between everything that you have seen and everything that he's about to say. So I appreciated that, because if he had tried to incorporate that into the show, then it's like, okay, well, now you're taking illusions and you're now conflating them, even if you're not trying to, you're forcing us to associate them with the magic of the Bible or the magic or the miracles of what Jesus did. It's like, and now it's like, yes, people are smart and they can intellectually separate the two, but instinctively, and I think that's what a lot of art does, certainly visual art, it acts first and foremost on our instinct and our emotions, and then the intellect comes in later. And so I appreciated that he delineated, but I also felt like, yeah, but now you've spent 45 minutes dazzling us saying that's not real, but this other thing that is also extremely unbelievable, that is real.
Yeah.
And you're not even seeing that. You just have to take people's words for it.
Yeah.
And so it does feel like, I understand why you'd want to incorporate that in the first place, but at the same time, it just feels like, I think I would have preferred you just separate it completely.
Yeah.
And so I don't begrudge.
If he were to do a magic show for kids at a hospital,
mm-hmm,
and said, I've got these talents, none of them are real magic, but I feel like God's given me the ability to do this and I'm doing it for the kids. And there was no message at the end. It was just using your talents, doing a thing for kids. That is more impactful and meaningful. The reason why I think of that is because I watched a documentary by Samaritan's Purse called Into Darkness or something that was about them fighting Ebola in Liberia, and all these things that these people who worked for Samaritan's Purse had done to save lives. It was amazing, very relevant for this moment.
Mm-hmm.
And they did it in the name of Christ, but that's what inspired them to do this good in the world.
Right.
Then at the end, there was a gospel presentation, like after the movie was done. I'm like, man, what a great movie telling this story of people working, helping people in the name. And then we got like Franklin Graham come on and he's like, and it was, of course it was defined, but it was pointless. It was unnecessary because you already know. It's that you could go read who Samaritan's Purse is and why they do this thing. And they mention that in the movie, but it was organic to the story to talk about it.
There's a comedian acquaintance of mine who said something once that it's very simple in what he is saying, but I find it really relevant to any number of things. He was talking, he goes to see a lot of concerts, and I forget what band he was talking about, but the band kept saying like, all right, stand up, make some noise. All right. You know, just like, he just kept telling the audience what to do. And the way he phrased it was, you know, if you do what you're supposed to do, we will do this naturally, you know? And I think that's absolutely true. Like, there is a reason that even though I don't really enjoy the Kendrick Brothers movies, years ago, I actually met Alex Kendrick at ICFF, your best friend, Alex Kendrick.
Yeah.
And I said, hey, I'm a film critic and I just want to let you know that I don't really like your movies that much.
Good.
And then I said, but I really like the spirit in which you make them. And I don't know if he, I wish that I had more time to explain that, because what I wanted to say was like, your films are personal. They clearly have to do with what you as a person are dealing with, as a husband, as a father, as a professional, as a Christian. And yes, sometimes you force things. Sometimes you're too overt about things, but maybe that's your life, whatever it is. But this feels like it comes out of you, as opposed to something like A God's Not Dead, which feels like it's just a calculation. It's just the filmmakers in the studio looked at like, okay, culturally, what's going on? How can we tap into that? And it didn't seem to come from any place inside them. And I do think that the best art is going to at least feel a little bit more organic when it is more personal, when it seems to spring out of something naturally. You know, and similarly, like when the documentary you're talking about, like if these characters, if these people are doing something and their reason is God, and then you're just focusing on the things they're doing, we will, you know, going back to that quote, like,
yeah,
we will respond naturally to your motivation, not merely what you're doing. We'll appreciate that. But when you, it's like, I love what this person is doing. And so if they say, well, the reason I did it was this, it seems unlikely that I'd say, oh, well, I'm not interested in that. Like you will probably be able to follow their line of logic and be like, oh, okay. And even if you wind up rejecting their motivation, you'll have a natural curiosity about it. And so you don't need to incorporate this. It starts with something very, very organic, very natural, and I think very personal to these workers. And then it switches into something much more objective and very impersonal.
Something that feels like an infomercial.
Yeah. And then now you feel like you've been manipulated. Like, mm-hmm. Oh, they pulled my, they tugged on my heartstrings, mm-hmm. and they used this thing that I'm naturally inclined to be in favor of. And they're using it. It turns out it was just a big sales pitch.
Yeah.
You know? And if they had lopped off that thing at the end, then it could have still been a sales pitch, but it would have been a much more effective one. That's yep. what I mean between effective and clumsy manipulation, you know?
Yeah.
Like they could have cut out all mention of God from that documentary, and then and some would say that the film would benefit. But if they did make this sort of as a way of pitching Jesus, then like, okay, well then you just have it in there and you make it work a little bit. But the minute you say, hi, I'm so-and-so.
Yeah.
And I wanted to say, it's like, okay, now you've made what is covert overt.
Yeah.
And I feel like movies, whether they be documentaries or otherwise, rarely work when they are that upfront about it.
Well, I think speaking of documentaries and Christians and stuff like that, what I really love about your movie is just the fact that it is neutral. It's something that, you know, you would mention, I think, off the air, that there's a few parts in it where you feel you injected your own, you know, your own biases, I suppose.
Yeah.
But the fact that you are aware of that kind of is fine. I like that there's some personality. It's you doing so much of it. I don't know that I could even have the strength to be that neutral. And what every documentary is not neutral in one way or another. But even with that, you have that Simpsons clip that is you showing a moment where Christianity is made fun of, but it's not. I mean, it's funny and I laugh along with it, but it's not necessarily that you as a filmmaker are including that to make fun of Christians, but to document when people did make fun of Christians. And yeah. I would say all that to say, I think people should go check it out, because I think that's, it shows it's rare that you're going to get somebody who is so loving to Christian film that takes a neutral approach to it. It is hard to find people who are just yeah, I love Christian film. It's hard. Most people are either on one side or the other.
Yeah.
On the issue. Like, yeah, Christian movies suck, and here's why, and here's a, you know, I see people send me, anytime someone reviews God's Not Dead or something like it, I get an email. And a lot of times they're difficult to watch because I'm like, this is just snotty and rude. Or it's stuff that's just like, oh, this was great and wonderful. And I mean, in politics, I sometimes wish that there was just somebody who could take themselves out of the emotion of the situation or the emotion of what's being said and dive into the emotion of the fact that it's being made and the culture surrounding it being made. Because there is something emotional about nostalgia and history and discovering it. Like, I find your film interesting because it's stuff that I didn't know, and it's cool to see like where all of this came from and the way people were thinking out, but separate, like removed from the, you know, like an alien looking in on this culture, but the human connection. So I'm rambling a little bit about it. I'm not asking a question about it. I want people to know that it's an interesting film that they should go watch.
Well, thank you very much. And, you know, in making it, because the film can kind of be, even though it's split up into multiple sections, when it comes right down to it, it can be split into two sections, history and analysis. And at about the 40 minute mark, that's when it switches. And what's interesting is, as I was making it for the first 40 minutes, I thought like, man, am I just coming down way too hard on Christians and the way they approach movies? And then the second half, where I'm really trying to delve into Christian film as its own artistic expression, I thought like, am I being too much of an apologist for Christian film? Am I letting it off the hook? And it's interesting that maybe that's the thing that surprised me most, is less any of the individual material, more so than paying attention to myself while I was, and my own reactions, because I thought like, isn't it interesting that, because like I try to openly acknowledge the inherent flaws in a lot of modern Christian filmmaking. But I also try to say like, yes, that is a flaw, but let's look at what's behind it. Mm. And instinctively I thought like, by not just piling on, am I letting it off the hook? And it's just like, and those are two extremes.
Yeah.
And there's such an either or attitude that I fell victim to it myself, not necessarily in what I was writing, but as I was putting it together, I thought like, oh my gosh, am I being too easy on this? Mm-hmm. And I realized like, oh yeah, no, that's, I fell into the same trap where I thought like, no, these movies, they need to be piled on a little bit more. And it was very, and so thankfully when people, a number of people that have reviewed it have commented on its neutrality, and I was like, okay, I guess that's good. I'm glad that nobody is saying like, oh wow, he's really defending these Christian movies,
yeah,
or he's coming down really hard on Christians. So it's like, I guess when you're worried that you're offending this person or you're offending the opposite, hypothetically, you're either absolutely offending both or you're not offending either one.
Yeah.
And it sounds like it was neither one, which instinctively the contrarian part of me is like, well, I don't like that.
Right.
Like,
what am I doing then?
Exactly. Yeah. It's like, I'm a very opinionated blowhard. So for me to have made a movie that is not that, I feel mm-hmm. like I'm selling out something. I don't know.
Yeah.
But
I mean, as somebody who reviews movies, my head gets into that space, especially when I started this podcast. Like, I was afraid people were going to think that I sold out. I've had people say that, you know, like, well, you've gotten soft on Christian movies. I don't think I have. I think I've been
I don't think you have.
Hard on Christian movies. But you know, I've had people say that I used to be harsher, and I think I used to be more flippant.
Sure.
You know, I used to be more, matter of fact about things I didn't know about, but some of that's just like being young and being an idiot. But I think I'm, I care more about the education that I can get from knowing why a movie is bad now than I used to. I like being funny, but I care more about what I can learn than making jokes at the expense of somebody.
Yeah, you know, it's I recently recorded an episode with our friend Brad Jones, the cinema snob. And before we started recording, we were just talking about like certain people's, like other online critics and just the people, even something like CinemaSins, not to pile on them. Actually, I'm fine with that.
Yeah, they need it.
I'm good. I'm good with it. I'm not going to lose any sleep over that. But just this idea of just either just boiling movies down to trivia, as in like, I know the year it came out. I know everybody, I know the name of every crew member and every award it won. Or boiling it down to just like a check mark or something like that.
Plot holes, continuity errors, all the...
Or just boiling it down to, have you seen it? You have?
Oh, okay, I gotcha.
You're acceptable then.
Yeah, there's a lot of gatekeeping.
Yeah, that is perfect. And to me, it's like, yeah, and this is something that I myself, you know, I don't know if this is something you deal with, but I know that I know a number of critics, including myself, who deal with imposter syndrome and worry that they're a fraud. Like when you put yourself out there, it's like, I know enough to put my make my opinion public. There is this tendency to feel like, oh, good Lord, what if I'm an idiot? What if I'm just a giant moron and I have no right to express my opinion to one person, much less a whole bunch?
Well, I think it was on your podcast where I was talking about doing reading scripts and stuff. And, you know, that's a feeling that I get when I'm like, what if I'm wrong about this? What if this isn't, you know, I'm like, hey, you should change this dialogue. You should make this character older. And then they do it. And then someone, you know, people watch it and they're like, why was the character so old or something, you know, like...
And that's the thing is I feel like everything is so black and white online when it comes to whether it be politics or religion or art discussion.
There's no nuance.
There's no nuance. And when it comes right down to it, film criticism, and this is something I've understood as I have gotten older, because after a certain point, you're just like, man, who cares? I mean, you care, but you also realize like there is so much more to be mined out of a movie than simply even just the artistic elements. You know, like when you see how they're all working together, to me, like I used the term earlier that even if you have a full technical understanding of everything a director did, there is something a little bit intangible that you can't easily put into words that explains why such and such a movie works. And to me, in discussing, not solving, but in discussing that intangibility, that's the real exhilaration of film criticism. And that's where I've had some of my best thoughts, where I've heard somebody else express something. It's like, I never would have thought of that. That's amazing. And so like at Battleship Pretension, we have kind of a joke where we'll discuss a certain topic. We'll devote an episode to a certain topic and we'll just swirl around it and discuss anything that comes to mind. And by the end, we've come to no conclusion. And we make a joke that like, they're like, well, once again, we've talked around a subject without actually figuring it out. And it's like, that's because it can't be figured out.
Yeah.
And that's okay. And
it does what some of these movies should do. It leaves it up to the audience to think about that thing and draw conclusions for themselves.
Yeah. And so it is interesting to see myself or anybody else like fall into this black or white attitude. And as you're talking about, like, there are people who are saying like, oh, you used to be harsher on these and the way, and in your mind, it's like you used to be more flippant and more probably dismissive of them. And simply by trying to approach them, not to defend and not to offend, but simply to analyze and to engage with, that's a word I use a lot, where you're engaging with this thing rather than sitting back with your arms folded saying like, what can you do for me? Will you tell me what I like or tell me what I don't? And instead it's like, no, let's actually go back and forth with the film itself. And for some people, that's not what they want. They want sarcasm. They want dismissive. They want black or white. And that's it, you know? And to me, it's like, what I was saying with Brad is like, isn't that exhausting and ultimately boring after a certain point? Like, what is the point of art if you simply just like, okay, I will now categorize it as good or bad. The end.
I think we said this off the air, but it's like a mirrored approach to the way Christian movies approach film. So you're, I think Christian movies, they don't feel like they're manipulating or using magic because they do believe that the thing that they're saying is true. Mm-hmm. But to anybody who doesn't believe in that, they're approaching believing it's not true. And so then you're like, it's just as true as some magician saying, look, I spoke to the dead, and using just, you know, that manipulation. If you're not a Christian, or you are a Christian, you hear that, you're like, well, that's wrong. You're manipulating people. But if you believe that it's true, then maybe it's true. And then, so it's the same approach from the other side of, I'm entering into this review and I'm going to say, I do not believe in this. And so this movie sucks because they believe a thing that's different than the thing that I believe. And that's tiring, that black and white kind of approach, because to me, with what you do with your the reason why I think that your movie is neutral is because you're approaching with the desire to learn a thing. I don't care what their beliefs were. You can, like, if you study the pagan rituals.
Yeah.
I have no agenda to figure out, to try to show them looking, to prove to people the pagans were wrong. I just am interested in knowing what they did. You can learn about, you know what I mean? Like, you can learn about a group of people and what they did and learn about what their motivations for doing it were. And that, to me, is an honest approach to something. And pointing out, oh, they murdered children. I can present that and not be endorsing it. And with presenting it is kind of a criticism of it while still being neutral. Like, yes, I think it was bad that they sacrificed children by presenting it to people. And most people will agree. Oh, yeah, that is bad. Where if you're approaching something with that agenda, then whether for or against, then you may be satisfying an audience that is looking for somebody to talk bad about a group of people they don't like, but it doesn't actually get you to what you're looking for, which is more knowledge. It doesn't help you learn a thing. So if you went and approached your movie with, let's show how dumb these Christians are, well, that would be easier for you, and it might get more clicks and money, which of course is what you're looking for.
Obviously.
But it wouldn't accomplish the thing that you actually were looking for, which is to learn about a subculture that you didn't know a lot about.
Yeah, there's I think I referenced it earlier, there's this wonderful movie, Glengarry Glen Ross, based on a David Mamet play. And there's a moment where this character, Ricky Roma, is talking he's drunk. And so you discover later that he's actually, this is all in a very involved sales pitch, but he's not talking about it at all. But he's talking about, like, taking risks in life. And only when you realize where he's headed, do you look back on everything he said previously, like, oh my gosh, this is amazing. But anyway, the point is, he's talking about, like, the risks in life and the things that define you. And he says, like, he's like, okay. He says, so you believe this, and then what? And to me, it's that question, and then what? Like you mentioned, the depiction of child sacrifice. Okay, and now if you made a film that showed that this culture sacrificed children, and that was bad, well, I hate to say it, but in 2020, I'm going to guess that about 100% of any of the viewers would already agree with you. So it's like, okay, it's evil. And then what? If you're simply presenting something that is already true, or at least true for your audience, and you're not providing any kind of commentary or any kind of illustration or anything that makes them think a little bit deeper about that thing, then why does it even exist? You know, maybe it's something you feel very passionately about, but then the question is, just because you feel something passionate, does that mean you have to put that on film? If you feel, I feel passionately against child sacrifice. And it's like, and I'm going to make a movie about it. Like, well, I guess people like being told they're right. But at the same time, I would say that's, and of course, anything the way it's made can make something essential. But at the same time, it's this idea, after a certain point, it can just become pandering. And that in the end is not super helpful.
Well,
and once again, this conversation that we're having is also kind of swirling around and not and following one, going down this trail and going down that trail.
That's every conversation for me.
And I love that. Like, to me, one of the things that has gotten to me about this quarantine is that one of my favorite things to do is to go out with a friend to a diner and spend 4 hours drinking coffee and talking about whatever. Now, I can still do that over Skype or Zoom or whatever, but admittedly, two dimensions is different than three. That's one of my favorite things to do, is talk about this stuff, even if we don't come to a concrete conclusion. And so maybe because of that, maybe that's why I tend to like movies that have a similar sensibility.
Yeah.
You know, my favorite movie is Nashville, directed by Robert Altman, 1975. I adore it. And that's a movie, it's hard to know exactly what Altman is saying. And to me, that's part of the fun, is trying to figure out less what is he saying. It's important to try to figure out what a director is trying to say, but at the same time, but what did it stir up in me as a viewer? You know, Gene Siskel once said that like writing a review is essentially like writing just a straight news piece. But instead of a car accident, you are reporting on your opinion. And so you're not even reporting on the movie. Part of it is, obviously, you're talking about the plot, but you're talking about your opinion, what it made you think about. And to me, that's so much more interesting than saying, it's like, oh, a review is less about getting all your opinions out there than trying to be true to the way the film made you feel. And so the idea of someone saying that you're going soft on Christian film, it's like, this, if you look at Christian film and opinions objectively, then who knows, maybe that's true. But if your reviews are simply you being true to your own opinion, and that's what ultimately it is, it's a snapshot of where you are right now in your life as you approach these movies. And to me, anybody that tunes in, it can be fun to watch somebody bash something that's obviously bad. But A, I don't view what you do as bashing. And B, like, after a certain point, that gets boring. I'm much more interested in somebody who's willing to navigate the nuances, or sometimes lack of nuance, of a movie. Sorry, I went on for a while there.
No, good. I'm glad. I had done that several times, so I think you...
Fair enough.
I've talked most of this podcast, so...
I want to assure the listeners that the narration in my film is much more focused.
It's great. Well, man, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me. This was delightful.
I could go on for hours and hours talking about movies, talking about Christian movies, talking about all of these things, but we can't.
Yeah.
So I guess we'll end the podcast.
I have to record another podcast in a half hour. So,
all right, man. Something. Well, thanks so much for coming on the show. And that'll be it. Is there anything you wanted to like say before I left?
We already plugged the movie enough. So who cares?
All right. Who cares? Bye.
Yeah.